Good morning from Zurich. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up on today's program, my guest, Juliette Linley, is here. She's back. Also, Marcus Schugel is back. I mean, really sort of a surprise appearance in such a short period of time. Also, a new voice around the table today. Goran Filic is also here with us. He'll tell us a little bit about his daily gig. But first, Juliette, again, highlighters at the ready, newspaper pages out. What have you spotted for us in the papers of the world?
How can I not bring up the fact that the Swiss president just visited the Pope, two areas of my expertise? And I'm going to not only tell you that they discuss the multi-million-dollar Swiss Guard barracks that need renovating, but also about what she brought him, and you'll be surprised by the gifts she brought.
Okay, well, we look forward to hearing about that in a few minutes. Also, our design editor, Nick Manise, gives us the latest view from London, and we'll also be getting the latest news from Ljubljana.
I'm Monocle's man in the Balkans, Guy Delaunay, and there's a transport theme to my regional roundup with Chinese trains, monochrome taxis, and a free cable car.
Plus, we'll speak to the editor-in-chief of Le Grand Continent magazine, Matteo Malik, about their latest print edition. It's the 5th of May, 2024, live from Zurich. This is Monocle on Sunday.
Live from Zurich, this is Monocle on Sunday with Tyler Brulé.
And good morning from a rather cloudy, somewhat humid Zurich this morning. Welcome to, I don't know, I was sometimes thinking we should put edition numbers on this program. Have we done hundreds of shows, Juliette? Is it,
or I feel thousands.
That could be like thousands. You never
incredible.
Know. Very nice. It's been ages. I have to say, listeners, that Juliette and your husband, you cooked a fantastic feast last night.
Feast.
It was fantastic.
No famine, just feast. Yes, we did. I've got a story about how famine is maybe not good for you, so let's quit of this intermittent fasting. But yes, and we watched an amazing film.
We watched an amazing film, and we can talk about the film in a moment. Hopefully, it was educational for your kids. But I think your daughter checked out halfway through.
Exactly.
Anyway,
it
doesn't matter. Marcus Schugel is also here as well. You've had a busy week at St. Gallen, and of course, you're a regular voice around the microphone. You were only just with us last week as well. We were talking about things on campus, but it's been a big, probably actually one of the headline weeks for St. Gallen, of course, where you're teaching marketing.
Yeah, funny-wise, it's not even done by the university, but it's done by a separate student committee. Since 53 years, students organize a symposium where right about this week, 1,200 executive students, researchers come together for discussing the pressing issues of society regarding the exchange between young and old. And the topic this year was confronting scarcity. We had executives like Carsten Sprohr from Lufthansa. We had Karin Kellersutter, the CFO of Switzerland, how I call her almost all the time. We had Ms. Navalny, she was there. Vladimir Klitschko was there. So there was a lot of crowd about the pressing topics. And the idea was to bring together the young perspectives, the executives' perspectives, the societal perspectives, and get into very good dialogues. And I think this year it was really intense. And it was interesting to see most demonstrations, and this is where this symposium comes from the ages of the late 60s, where everybody had the feet on the street. And the university at that time said, when the students want to organize something, do something that brings up a dialogue between the generations. And this has prevailed since then. So it's an institution in St. Gallen. University works ever on. There's no disruption, and they just organize it separately, and it works like a Swiss clockwork. It's really amazing what those students are doing. They get off those studies for 1 year. They only do this. And you see how proud they are of what they've achieved. And they can be. It's really amazing venue all the time.
But of course, as a lecturer and teacher on the topic of marketing, Where does it sit? Because on one side, it's as you say, it's almost a great recruiting tool, because I was at the symposium a few years ago, and it's just amazing. All these students that you encounter, and they're top of their game. You think, I would hire you. I've got a job for you. Yeah. Is that part of it? Or is it, would you say, more just a very positive, important halo effect for St. Gallen University as a whole? But as you said, at the same time, it's its own separate entity, too.
Yeah. I think this whole recruitment stuff is something that comes with it. That's normal when you bring young people and executives together. On the other hand, it's really about exchanging and really bringing up opinions. And I think what students are taught in that context is that they speak up, that they make their minds up, that they have an opinion, that they push forward their topics in a way that you can discuss them. And they are hosting the stuff. They are training you. They're briefing you on everything that you do. They're organizing. It's so professional. You always tell yourself, "Oh my goodness, huh?
I've also, I'm happy to say that Goran Filic is here as well. He's a professor of political science at Franklin University, just down the train tracks, rather slow train tracks at the moment, because the Gotthard Tunnel is not fully up and running. But this, of course, is the Ticino, the Lugano campus of the school. Welcome. Very, very nice to see you. Tell us a little bit about your daily gig as a professor, political science, and in a Ticino heart of Europe context.
Ticino, heart of Europe context. I teach a class on European Union and current issues. I try to explain the students how the EU came about. What is the future of European Union, in particular the eastern part or the Western Balkans. And then I teach a couple more classes, international relations. And international political economy class.
I'm curious. We were touching on the topic last week. We had also one of your other colleagues on the program. The mood on campus, U.S. university again in Europe. Of course, we've seen, even in the last week. Of course, sit-ins, encampments. Of course, spread to this side of the Atlantic as well. There was a little bit of contagion. How's the mood at Franklin?
It's peaceful, and I think they're managing it well. It's a campus that that's split between the American and European students, plus some other nations. And I think the way university approach it is to keep it calm. Some other, and I think this is this has something to do with the way maybe. Private universities approach some hot topics versus some other universities where maybe a conversation or the debate would be a little bit more open.
Even spicy. Juliet, we were talking last night. Your daughter is going to be heading off to university in a little over a year, and we were playing campus applications where she might end up in the world. It sounds like is the family pushing for her to stay on this side of the Atlantic as opposed to going further afield?
Possibly for financial reasons, yes.
As well.
Also because Europe has not a small amount of very good and very prestigious universities. But speaking of the sort of protests and everything, and we were asking her about it and who's involved and who's not involved and how it's escalating, there's a great piece by Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times opinion poll where he's saying two very concrete ways to meaningfully help the Gazans, because these protests are not helping. A, set up fundraise for organizations like Save the Children and so on that are helping the Gazans, and also go there, visit the place, go volunteer, study in the West Bank. I did that. But do you know what I mean? You're never going to understand the issues, and they are such deep issues if you actually don't do that.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly been quite a large narrative, certainly even in the U.S. press as well, piece in the Wall Street Journal this week, and also talking about just the level of organization as well that has gone into this, that this is not spontaneous, that this has been, 4 months in the works, and this was mass mobilization, a lot of money on the other side going in just to get this message across. And I think what that's meant as well. And then I think again, I would say some critical or maybe pragmatic voices will then go there and make your way to Cairo and work with an NGO if you want to do well, rather than only just talking about defunding as well.
But so perhaps my daughter's headed to Ramallah. Yeah. There you go.
Good. I mean, maybe that is a start. But I'm also just interested as well. Of course, this is a city, lots of international schools as well. Has that been a topic too? Let's say at international schools here as well. And of course, when you have a lot of American expats and expat students, is this something that there's a fear of it flaring up, or has it flared up?
I think
up?
There is a bit of a fear of it flaring up, and therefore they've been damping down on the discussions, because there is such a mix of students. We're talking about high school. It's not at our school.
You say damping and water cannons around the school?
They really don't want to initiate these discussions with the kids because they're always scared of stepping on some ethnic minority or some nationalistic theme that will step on toes of people. So unfortunately, and my daughter's the first one to raise this topic, she says when we try to bring up, you're nodding, Goran, but yes, when we try to bring up these topics, they kind of just brush us aside. So I said, so we have those discussions at the dinner table instead. But that's unfortunate for those children who maybe don't have those discussions at home. Goran.
If I can, I'll give you an analogy to keep away some of these debates. It's exactly what happened in former Yugoslavia in the 70s, 80s, and the 60s, is to keep the sort of nationalistic debates. So the government kind of just pushed it away or put it under the carpet. And then in the 1990s, all that flared up. Yeah. If you opened the discussion to the people in the 50s and the 60s, if you had an open debate, and maybe some people would get their feelings hurt, but nonetheless, it would prepare them. It would prepare them to hear that maybe somebody doesn't agree with them, or perhaps even doesn't even like them, which is not to say that they maybe hate them. It's just, you know, I'm not familiar with you, I don't like you. And I think we should be, bring a society to be okay with that. I'm okay if somebody doesn't like me. I'm completely okay. But there's a fine line between likeness, hate, and that flaring up into a conflict. And so I think today we live in a society where we are pushed to like everything, like everybody, love everybody. I don't think that's a reality.
Well, this is interesting, Marcus, from a brand perspective. When you think about also, you know, everyone talks about love brands and everything, and everyone has to fall in love with you. And does this become also a topic right now? Because we can talk about it on a political, societal level, but also when you're a major corporate and you're terrified of just one wrong social post. Oh, people may not like my brand of cereal. Yeah. They're not happy with our new color of car.
That's a huge topic for many years already. When we talk about diversity, when you look at Oreos and the stories that is behind it, it's a huge topic. Or even if you think of Bud Light in the United States. But the idea behind it is that we are swiftly moving away here in Europe from the idea of the love brand, because we say it's not about love, it's about trust. And the idea of being a trust brand might be much, much more important. And with this, there comes another topic that is inherited in branding. You can't be everybody's darling. You need to have some edges. You know, you need to be in favor of certain things. Because if you're loved by everybody, you're loved by nobody.
Yeah, I mean, you say on that as well, having some edges, etc. Where do you think we've landed on the political topic? You talked about, obviously, you know, the Bud Light controversy. Maybe many people saying, well, actually, thinking about our core brand, was it right to have a trans ambassador? Yeah. Maybe yes, maybe no. Yeah. Probably on the side of no, given where we are now. Where are companies sitting? Because, you know, and again, there's always that pressure, of course, from the shareholders, from the kids of the CEOs and the exec co-members.
They're right in the middle of the hurricane right now, and I think that they're really struggling with the idea that it's not always about being, you know, differentiating yourself on political ideas might be cast away the challenges that you have in your core product. Many people are referring to the problem of Bud Light, that they're not differentiated in their core product. And when you go now something for that just differentiates over a campaign, you're losing out because there's no real reason, no reason why to buy the product on the one hand. And on the other hand, of course, we've got the challenges that you need to get into those topics because of the purposeful branding and all that stuff. From my point of view, I think it's like you said, you don't need to like each other. Even if you don't like a brand, it's fine with me, but you don't need to hate them.
Yeah, you know?
What's the Oreo cookie story? I missed that.
The Oreo cookie story is that Oreo is for the last 10 to 15 years, Oreo has always played very strongly on the topic of diversity and of inclusion. And they put that topic to the table already before the purpose discussion came up. So Oreo has a long tradition in taking up certain stuff. They made very strong advertisements, even for the Super Bowl, that were really interesting to differentiate themselves within the community, which is a huge part of the target group. You know? So with them it works. But if you are sort of a beer brand that says, oh, let's do something with an influencer that comes out of a very diverse culture, just to make us favorable within this whole society of purposeful marketing, yeah, that's like greenwashing, you know, and people get this very fast.
Indeed. I want to bring in Nick Manis, our design editor. I believe he's standing by in London for us this morning. I hope he is. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning, Tyler Brillet. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much, Nick Manis. Listen, it's very formal. I like it. I mean, I like a bit of Sunday morning formality. Listen, tell me, we could either sort of go right in on what's happening in London at the moment. We already had the weather forecast, or at least the current weather report from Emma Nelson. So we can skip over that. Also, you're, what are we, 10 days, 12 days, is it 2 weeks past, of course, Salone finished. I think you've recovered. You're gearing up. We've got a trip, I know, to Spain next week. You're going to be heading off to Denmark and not too long a trip. Are there any other sort of major design exhibitions that are vying for your attention?
I mean, This is the big period after Salone. I feel like we have about a 2 week cooling off period where we sober up, you know, maybe get in the sun, some sauna, sweat it out, that sort of thing. And now it's really this huge run of, so there's New York by Design, which starts on the 16th of May. You've got Clerkenwell in London, which is a little bit more, I guess, business focused, less about, I guess, fun and play like these other fairs. But that starts on the 21st of May. Melbourne Design Week kicks off on the 23rd. Orgatech in Tokyo, where we're talking about office space, is on the 29th. London Festival of Architecture. And then to cap off or really kick off summer and that break where the design industry finally relaxes, you've got 3 days of design in Copenhagen on the 11th of June. So it's this huge, huge run leading in, and it really is truly global, which is what I kind of love at this stage. So until now, there's probably not been much in North America to get excited about this year, but New York by Design really kicks that off, and then, as I said, Melbourne, Tokyo, and then Copenhagen.
Have you somehow sort of managed to wangle your way onto a Qantas flight? Are you heading to Melbourne, or it sort of sounds like that you're going to sort of be officiating there, but I've not seen the travel request.
This is
yet.
Me making the slow put. I'm just putting it on your radar and making sure it's on there. Maybe next year, a nice business class Qantas flight down under would be a treat. But no, we'll have some of our correspondents from the Asia bureaus down there reporting, and that's also quite fascinating. I mean, I had Tom Faraday in the studio. He's this marvelous Australian designer. He was in London off the back of Salone, like a lot of Antipodean designers. And we're having a little bit of a chat about, I guess, the growth and significance of Melbourne Design Week. I mean, I think a couple of years ago, it felt a little bit dinky and a little bit local, probably also hampered by, you know, Australia's bad behavior during the pandemic and kind of locking everyone out. But now it's really trying to establish itself as a regional force. And just seeing, they were talking about the number of Asian designers and Asian brands coming down and really, I guess, trying to give the Australian design population, the Antipodean design population, something to be excited about. Because I think these events, and Salone is the prime example, it's about business, but it's also about having a moment to kind of bring everyone together. And it's about those business deals that take place off the back of these events.
Nick, as we head towards summer, of course, we'll see, you know, mass demobilization in offices, of course, all over Europe, particularly France. Everyone is sort of, you know, it seems like all of France is just checking out completely during the Olympic period. But I just want to maybe sort of swing our lens towards Orgatech in Tokyo. And I think one of the fascinating things is we certainly notice when you spend time in Europe, then you go to North America, then you're in Asia, just office, you know, occupancy rates, you know, who's there? Who's in the office 100%, who's never there, also the fights and challenges that of course come with it, people, you know, crossing their arms, I don't want to go into the office, others who are completely thrilled that they have actually a proper space to function and perform, and the privacy that you can even get in an office versus being maybe in a very small apartment in Seoul or Tokyo. Do you have a read off the back of Salone and certainly other fairs that you've been to, the type of transformation that we're seeing in the workplace? Because I can imagine, you know, we've got a couple of summers, you know, where we've had this sort of moment of reckoning. I think if you're a business leader, you're able to take stock, Nick, and you're able to say, okay, how do we want to sort of reconfigure? How do we want to rethink our office when people come back already in September? What are we going to do in terms of refitting across, you know, July and August, you know, no matter where you are in the world? What's the read of that, of the office space looking like from your perch?
I mean, I think there's a few things that are going on. I get the sense that it certainly changes continent by continent almost, or region by region. Like, you know, you go to North America, you go to a cafe on a weekday and, I don't know, you could be in Milwaukee and it will be covered with people, you know, essentially setting up dual monitors, trying to work from this cafe, like completely taking over. Versus maybe in London, you see a little bit less of that. But I think what you see off the back of these fairs and the conversations that I'm having, it's about, well, if you're going to, you know, want people to come into the office, you know, and maybe there's a hesitancy from some people who would rather just stay home and kind of put their washing on and maybe answer some emails in amongst that. If you're going to bring people back, you need to make them want to commute. So you need to make a place where people want to spend time. And certainly a starting point for that is by making it perhaps more appealing than their home, by investing in quality furniture, by having nice lighting, by having comfortable chairs that people actually want to sit and spend time in. And I think you pair that, and another discussion I've been having is you pair that with building services. So, you know, are you choosing a place that maybe has a nice gym within proximity? Have you set up a deal for them where, you know, somebody might want to come in and then they work out after work? Are you also partnering with, do you have a concierge? Do you have somewhere where you can have packages delivered safely that you might not be able to have at home? So it's these, I guess the furniture and the fit out is one element, but then there's also, a service perspective that people need to consider. And I'm not just saying this because I have all my personal items delivered here to us at Midori House, but it is nice to have that 24-hour security and knowing that my presents from my mother in Australia are going to arrive safely.
Absolutely. But do you think also this sort of uneven return, not return to the office, is also part of, on one side you could say, Asia in many big markets, there is, of course, if you're in a small apartment in Hong Kong, do you want to be, you can't even get a depth of field if you're on a video call because, the wall is right behind your head because, you're in such a tiny space. Same in Tokyo, Seoul, many other cities as well. But also where we've seen, people happy to return because, there was also a proper investment in the work environment in the first place. So people are happy to return. And you could argue, in many places, in the US, yes, maybe architecturally fantastic buildings, but, oftentimes you look at the office stock and it's really left behind. I mean, it feels like you're still in the 1970s.
Yeah, I mean, so certainly there's that other element as well in terms of like actually having a nice building to be in. But I think there's also something to be said about that psychological shift. Like it is quite nice to, develop a routine, have somewhere where you can separate your home and work life. I mean, I know even just for me speaking personally, it's like my commute is actually, it's a 25-minute bike ride. It's where I have some of my best ideas. It's that moment to switch from work to home. And I think it's trying to, highlight and underline these. And maybe that starting point is, again, by having that place that earns the commute that then starts to shift these sorts of behaviors. And, I think regardless of whether you're in a small Tokyo apartment or, a large, harborside property in Sydney, so whether you have a home office or you're working at your dining table, I still think it's important to have these distinct places where we can work, where we can come together and where we can be creative. And I think, and you mentioned North America there as the example, I think it's trying to convince people that this is a worthwhile investment because of that, because of these benefits, because there's certainly a mental health part that comes into this. And, getting people out of their homes, getting people into their communities, getting them playing a role in this, spending money at the local coffee shop near their office. I think that's incredibly important as well.
Let's talk about commutes, or maybe short commutes as well. Juliet, you teased a story as well, which is also about, workplace, sleep place, and this is the Vatican.
That's
this,
a segue.
Yeah, but it's true. This is, again, this is about a big investment that, of course, is going to happen, potentially happen at the Vatican, largely underwritten by the Swiss as well. But it's a story that you picked up on the Swiss Guard.
I thought you were going to ask me about how the Pope commutes to the office. Well, you see him just wandering around the Vatican. I mean, now maybe more in a wheelchair, but when I was there, he would just walk around the corner. You'd be like, okay.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, and I thought you were going to ask me about biking work. Not talking about that. We're talking about the Swiss president meeting the Pope and reassuring Pope Francis that Switzerland supports the creation of these, not creation, the rehabilitation and reconstruction of these Swiss Guard barracks that are pretty old. They're getting a bit decrepit. They're inside the Vatican walls. And that is where the more or less 130 plus Swiss guards actually live. And it's interesting because on the one hand, it costs about half, 500,000. How much was it? Wait, hang on. Total cost $55 million.
Yeah, 50 million.
That's a lot per head. Right? And they're short $1.5 million, which means they've raised a lot. It's a foundation raising the money. So it's not the Swiss government is contributing, the Vatican are contributing, but it's a lot of private funding as well.
Yeah.
And also it's of course controversial because not all Swiss cantons want to be part of that contribution. Geneva said, forget it. In the name of secularism, we don't want to be part of this. 2 years ago, Lucerne, similarly, we're not going to contribute 400,000. You got the SVP, the conservatives in Switzerland, who of course aren't very much in favor of this. But then you, so you come to, on the one hand, you've got to restructure these barracks. They need better bathrooms, rooms, etc. On the other hand, it's getting increasingly difficult to find young Swiss men who want to go and be a Swiss guard. You earn $1,300 a month, which for a Swiss youngster is nothing.
No.
In other countries, it might be great. You've got to be a practicing Catholic.
You have no expenses, and you get to wear...
board and lodging.
Nick, look at...
You wear a great outfit.
Yeah, I was going to say, Nick, look at... You get to wear stripy pantaloons, and you get to wear a fantastic...
This is sounding very appealing. Where do I get my Swiss passport? How do I go about that?
You get a Swiss passport. You need a parish priest to vouch for your Catholicism,
You are Catholic,
Nick?
Aren't you, Nick?
Catholic boys school. I've got the priest ready to go.
He's halfway there, isn't he?
How tall are you? 174 minimum height?
He's a giant.
Oh, 186. Yeah, measured yesterday.
We're fine. What else is there? Yeah, so increasingly they're trying to see whether you can include women who can go and serve as Swiss guards, but that hasn't passed. Anyway, so you have these two sides to it. Same time, Viola Amherd, the president, brought, of course, gifts for the Pope.
Okay, what did the Pope get?
Okay, Pope got chockies.
Oh, really? You surprised us.
Yeah. Right? He got a jug and goblets with a reproduction of the Matterhorn. Could you see you having that in your living room? Not sure.
Well, we have to bring Emma in on that in a moment.
Is he even allowed to keep his gifts? But anyway, then he got Swiss stamps from the year of his birth, 1936.
Okay, yeah, he could use those.
What are you going to do? Well,
I know, he might frame them or something.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And then he got a CD of Argentinian tangos. Well, hello.
He got a CD.
Of Argentinian tangos. He is from Argentina. Do you think he doesn't already have
He probably has it. Right. Okay.
That's the
personal. No, we're going to let Emma read the news. Nick, stick around because we have to reflect on this. Emma Nelson's back in London with the news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed, Tyler. Talks to secure a deal for a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of hostages continue today in Cairo. The main issue appears to involve whether any ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel will be permanent or temporary. Ukraine's come under further heavy bombardment by Russian missiles, with attacks on Ukraine's Kharkiv and Dnipro regions and the Black Sea port of Odessa, with at least two people reportedly killed. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and European Union leaders have denounced a recent series of attacks on politicians in Germany. On Friday, a member of Herr Scholz's Social Democrats was seriously injured by a group of people while putting up posters in Dresden. And a display of small knitted figures featuring full frontal nudity has caused a commotion at a cafe in the west of England. The handcrafted creations are the product of a weekly knitting circle in Shepton Mallet. The collection includes a well-endowed policeman, vicar and a woman wearing pearls. It's showcased in the window of The Hive, a beloved craft and haberdashery cafe on the High Street. The display hasn't gone down well with one local resident who expressed concern about her grandchildren being exposed to knitted genitals on their school route. And those are the headlines. Back to you, Tyler, in Switzerland.
Thanks very much for that. It carries on with the gift theme as well. It's good that Viola Amherd didn't show up to the Vatican with those. But Nick, I want to bring you in on this as well. Is this a lost opportunity for Switzerland? We hear about goblets and jugs, and not jugs on knitted figures either. but we're talking about of course, representing Switzerland. Obviously, Switzerland has a very strong tie, of course, to the Vatican because of the Swiss Guard. If you were the head of protocol for the Vatican, would you be happy with, you know, the jug and goblets with the Matterhorn on them? Or could Switzerland have done a better job selling, of course, their design attributes, you know, all of the great talent that's in this country?
I mean,
what do you think?
I've got to wonder if they've got enough jugs and goblets at the Vatican. Like, what is this doing a service to them? I mean, there's also that element of, like, when you get a gift, you don't want to just pop it straight in the cupboard where you've already got a bunch of jugs and goblets, is what I'm guessing. But I think certainly... I mean, it's a little bit cliche, isn't it? I mean, I'd want to hear from the Swiss panelists, but to me, it feels a little bit cliche to have the Matterhorn.
And also, you'd wonder as well, because you're talking about the Vatican. Did she bring like a pallet? Did they bring a transport aircraft? Did she fill their Falcon jet? What's he going to do? What's the Pope going to do with four goblets and one jug? You know, if you go around to the private apartment,
maybe.
I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Maybe
you know, was
for
it
all the Swiss guards?
Was it for all of the Swiss guards? I don't know.
Sure. And no penknife, though, interesting.
Yeah. And I'm also wondering, where were they from? Hergisville? Were they made in Switzerland? Do we know? Was the chocolate from? Did you buy it at duty free? I don't know. Why?
The Toblerone.
I mean, I imagine.
But what would you want to receive? Exactly, Nick. What would you want to get?
If you were
from
the Pope, or if you were in your fancy pants as a Swiss guard, what would you like, Nick?
I mean, if I'm one of the Swiss guard, I mean, a pay rise sounds nice, but I know that's probably not happening.
Listen, you're living at the Vatican. You've got all expenses paid.
And
that's 1,300 francs in your pocket, in your pantaloon pockets every month.
I mean, what I'm thinking is, you know, and we had our pop-up radio at the House of Switzerland, Milano, during Milan Design Week. And that was really about showcasing a host of young, emerging Swiss talent. What I would be hoping for is for someone to, I guess, earmark that next generation of Swiss designers and maybe pick me a piece from there. Something, you know, that might go in the archive and be like, you know, we were the first to discover this. Emma Nelson's waving at me. I think she's got an idea for what
she
wants.
Yeah, I have an idea. Given the fact that you always have to think about who you're giving your gift to, and we haven't seen the Pope in terribly good shape recently, and I absolutely concur with Nick and his issues with, like, how many goblets does the Vatican need? I think they've got quite a few in the back cupboard. So, you know, one's immediately thinking, gosh, is this straight to eBay. Why didn't they send Schindler in to build him a really good lift so he can zip about the Vatican in his wheelchair? Super efficient, really well designed, and everybody will be happy.
Yeah, actually, and we've got Marcus is chipping in the back, but he said Schindler could also, they could do escalators there. Exactly. They could, don't
Brilliant.
You think, they could do moving sidewalks,
oh
right?
Goodness, the best gift ever.
Right? No, I think that could be a great use of soft power. Marcus, jump in here, please.
But Emma, you're so right. It's about the target group that you're giving a gift to. And being to the Vatican most times, 16th Chapel and all that stuff, the best thing would be you're on a small conveyor belt just running by the pictures. It would make much more less bumpy and much more comfortable. So that would be really great, something even for a tourism image of the Vatican.
I mean, it would fit right in with the style as well, so quickly as you're going down all those corridors.
Yeah, I believe. I think it's quite. It's a significant anniversary year for Schindler as well. So that's it all sort of fits something. In. Emma, just quickly on the topic of it's very difficult, of course, to recruit Swiss guards. Should we allow women into the Swiss Guards, or are we happy just leaving it as sort of a sacred job for the boys coming from Catholic valleys in the Alps?
It depends, because that is a very particular sort of recruitment group, isn't
you're
it?
You're talking when about you the outfit.
Are you suggesting that perhaps, you know, I might be inquiring about the availability of pantaloons anytime soon, and the hat?
Could be, exactly.
Okay, well,
and there's also a story about the helmet as well, because I believe there's been a project to also, because the helmet's heavy, it's metal, etc., to also do a not a Kevlar version, but anyway, I think
they're printing 3D ones.
Yeah, it's carbon fiber version. Nick, jump in here, help us out. I thought that was maybe your story.
I mean, you're going to have a strong neck to currently what they have. I mean, and to be honest, that might be the thing that trips me up. I have terrible posture. I don't know what I can do to fix that. Maybe some, I don't know, some weights, something like that. But I think how dangerous is it to be a Swiss guard? That would be my question.
Well, I think jump in on this one, because we've got the former Vatican correspondent here. Nowadays, how dangerous? Because they are part of the core body.
How many have fallen in the line of duty?
I want to know how effective these helmets would be in this day and age.
I thought you'd bring up helmet hair.
I mean, I like the plumage.
And instead,
yeah. Yeah.
Right. How dangerous is it? Well, yes. No, well, very important but role they play, but they work together with the gendarmerie, the Vatican gendarmes, who are actual police.
They're actual police.
So you're not just relying on 19-year-old boys from
Valais. It's a theatrical exercise, which is actually up my alley.
Well, no. They also have to have done their military service.
All of our Swiss Guard listeners on this program.
They're military trained.
They have to have done their Swiss military service.
Absolutely. And you don't want to get on the wrong side.
I think I might be picking, I'm definitely picking the wrong fight here, aren't I?
And they've been around since 1500, Mick.
Okay.
Right. Let's head to the Balkans right now. Let's see if there's any insight from the other side of the Italian border. We're heading to Slovenia right now. Our Guy Delaney is in Ljubljana for us this morning. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, all.
And anything to contribute to this Vatican discussion, or we want to talk about leadership and spirituality elsewhere?
All I know is my son just turned 18, and he had what seemed like an almost irresistible offer from the Slovenian military, which was that if he turned up to an open day, they would give him an army meal, which appears to have been a plate of beans. That was the incentive.
Okay, and was he racing down to the barracks?
He was not, funnily enough. And I actually don't know how many people actually turn out for this, because when you're 18 years old, probably you've got other priorities than going down to the exhibition centre in Ljubljana, getting yourself a plate of beans and seeing what the Slovenian military has to offer. So I can't actually tell you how many people turned up for that, because my son certainly didn't.
If we can do a little bit of a Jane's defense moment. Guy, tell us the Slovenian military, a very, very small stretch of coastline. So I would imagine not the most toothsome navy. But if we went to look at the runways and mountain bunkers, what's your assessment of the Slovenian armed forces?
Well, of course, Slovenia is a NATO member state. So, you know, we have all of the Adriatic coast now is covered by NATO members because Montenegro also got its membership a couple of years ago, just a little bit inland. North Macedonia's in now. So Slovenia is a part of the alliance. But it has to be said, I think, that the alliance is very much to Slovenia's benefit rather than the other way around, because the forces are very small here. In terms of actual military aircraft, I don't think they've got anything bigger than a trainer. So I don't think there's anything which can actually fire things, if you know what I mean. So it's very bijou, the Slovenian military, as you might imagine.
And are they, we're talking about the public coffer anyway. Do we know, are they going above their 2% contribution, or are they a bad boy of NATO?
Yeah, bad boy of NATO. I think that goes for the rest of the region as well. Maybe North Macedonia, I think, is just about doing it, but that's probably just because they're keen, because they've just started in NATO and they want to be good. And what you're seeing actually throughout the region now is a move as to, and we're talking about plates of beans here, about whether they should reintroduce some form of military service, not in the sort of Yugoslav style of actually having to spend a year or two somewhere else in the Republic and carrying out your military service properly, but even in terms of a military education for a few months, because they're very much aware that the military isn't attractive to young people in Slovenia, in Croatia, or indeed in Serbia these days.
You mentioned North Macedonia. Of course, there's you got an election story for us there. But would we say the biggest story, though, is of course Xi and we're talking about Xi Jinping. That is, and Serbia.
Absolutely. That's going to be the biggest story of the next week, because Xi Jinping is arriving in Serbia on Tuesday evening, and he'll be spending, I think, more or less all of Wednesday there. I've got my accreditation, so I'll be able to tell you exactly what he gets up to. But it's very curious, isn't it, Xi Jinping's European tour? He's chosen three countries, France, Hungary, and Serbia. And, you know, the choices... For those of us who don't follow the ironclad relationship between the ironclad friendship, I think they call it, between China and Serbia, you're probably scratching your head thinking, what on earth is Serbia doing in there? But, you know, there are all sorts of messages being sent, or at least I think those involved very much want us to think that there are messages being sent. And Chinese influence in Serbia is strong and it's growing. And when I was looking at the export figures for Serbia last year, for example, the largest exporters from Serbia at the moment are Chinese-owned companies, mostly involved in mining and metals.
We've got Goran here, who's kind of sort of semi sort of nodding his head. I'm not sure if he's agreeing or not. But I just want to, just before I bring you in as well, it's also interesting, Guy, when we sort of, let's say, you know, swing our gaze towards Budapest as well, because, you know, here, and I was talking to some EU members the other day, and some people from the diplomatic community, and just talking about again the Budapest Beijing relationship. When you talk about the power of the Chinese banks, you know, their back offices in Europe, etc., is also enormous as well, and also growing in influence.
And the thing which links Budapest and Belgrade is this railway which is being built with Chinese money, Chinese financing, and Chinese engineers. And that's a big deal. And in fact, Hungary's been running into trouble with that all along the way. It's been going much more smoothly in Serbia than it has been in Hungary. And that's largely because the EU has been taking fright at what's going on with a massive infrastructure project in one of its member states, leaving said member state in significant hock to Beijing. And all the way along, there's been issues with compliance on the Hungarian side of things. So this is, you know, stirring up some concern in Brussels, one has to say, vis-a-vis Hungary's relationship with China. And on the Serbian side of it, you know, we're going to have, I would have thought, if we're looking at transport infrastructure, that's going to be another one of the big themes of the visit. President Vucic of Serbia saying he's going to be looking for Xi Jinping to give help to restart Serbia's train manufacturing industry. And of course, by the end of the year, we should have a high-speed train from Belgrade all the way to the Hungarian border. You know, now you're just waiting for the two things to link up. But that's another symbol of what's going on.
Goran, is any of this surprising when you think about this type of friendship? When, of course, we look at Hungary, we look at Serbia, you know, bumpy relationships with their neighbors, certainly from a Budapest perspective, rocky relationship with Brussels, of course. So inevitable that, of course, they're looking for friendship in the east or east of their borders.
No, I mean, this is actually, everything is correct. China's presence in, not only in Serbia, but in the last couple of years, Chinese built that Pelješac bridge connecting the mainland with the southern part of Croatia. They're also building a main highway in Montenegro. They've also built highways in Serbia. They purchased natural resources in eastern part of Serbia on the border with Romania. The presence is something to do with the nationalistic politics in the Western Balkans, and it's been under President Vučić, it's been played more, and so the Serbia is kind of playing a role where, for the lack of a better word, blackmailing EU, they're looking towards partnership and in China.
And Guy, if I was to speed past any of these sort of grand projets that are happening, across the region, do we also see? Big billboards that these projects are proudly brought to you by the People's Republic as well.
Yeah, you'll see that. And when I went on the first part of this railway between Belgrade and Budapest, which goes from Belgrade to Novi Sad, the second largest city in Serbia, a couple of years back, and I was on board with President Vučić and also Prime Minister Orban of Hungary, and on the way back had a very entertaining time being plied with plentiful wine by President Vučić, saying, you must try this, guy, and topping my glass up with a very heavy elbow, it has to be said. That was a big deal, and Chinese engineers were very much in evidence at the launch of that part of the railway. When we had the opening in Belgrade, they were all on the platform there, very visible in the presentation, very visible in the media. So yes, this is very much played upon in Serbia, the benefits that the friendship with China is bringing. And time again, you get these messages coming out of Belgrade. Our direction of travel is towards the European Union, but we will not give up our friendships with Beijing or with Moscow.
Let's just stay on a transport theme. We probably have time for two more stories, but maybe we stick around in Belgrade for a little story about the taxi business.
Indeed, and this one tickles me, because if you take public transport of any sort in Belgrade in the past decade, you'll have been very confused as to what colour things ought to have been. Well, because you used to get the buses were red, yellow, blue, green, white. A few years ago, they sorted this out. Now all the buses have been painted, and not very well in some cases, but painted red. The taxis, meanwhile, as of this coming Wednesday, all have to be white. And this is a wheeze of the Belgrade city authorities. They've had 3 years notice in which to implement white taxis in Belgrade. So either you buy a new one or you paint your old one. The acting mayor, Alexander Šapić, has said this will ensure European standards in the city. And I have to say, as someone who regularly takes taxis in Belgrade, what we'd really like in terms of European standards are taxi meters that don't run super duper fast when you're not looking, and taxis which actually are properly licensed, and taxi drivers who don't smoke and have working seatbelts.
Right. Goran is now wincing as you say all of that. But just tell me, Guy, I would imagine this will be part of your reporting, of course, when you're there this week, to make sure that everyone is complying, of course, right? That every vehicle is. And is there a particular Pantone that they're working with? This is the other issue, of course, with one's Swiss brand book head on as well.
Yeah, I don't think there is. I mean, if we're looking at the kind of reds we've got for the buses, I think not. I think any kind of white will do, as long as it's whitish.
Okay. Should we go to North Macedonia, or do we want to go to Zagreb and ride on a cable car?
I think we should go for the cable car, but I think we should zip past North Macedonia as we go, because I hope we'll pick up on this later in the week on Monocle Radio, which is we've got a double election on Wednesday in North Macedonia, the second round of the presidential vote plus parliamentary elections. And the stakes are pretty high there in terms of the European Union path of North Macedonia, because it looks very much like the Vimero de Pemne party, which is right-wing-ish and very nationalist, is going to take charge. And they've been blocking constitutional changes in North Macedonia, which were agreed under a deal with Bulgaria, which has been blocking North Macedonia's EU membership negotiations. So that's one to look out for. But I think we need to get on this cable car, Tyler, because we like cable cars.
We love cable cars. Hello, absolutely. We're in Switzerland. Yeah, Juliet, you like a cable car, don't you?
That could have been a great gift for the Pope.
For the Pope as well. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And we have covered this one in Monocle magazine a couple of years ago, which was at the time the revival of Zagreb's cable car at Sljeme, which is quite close to the city centre, actually. And it goes up this mountain, Mount Medvednica, which is 1,000 metres, so it's not a huge mountain. But if it's cold enough, you can actually ski up there. And as of this weekend, it's free. If you're a Zagreb resident, you no longer have to pay to ride the Sljeme cable car. And this is something of a Damascene conversion, I think, by Mayor Tomislav Tomasevic. Because when he opened that cable car 2 years ago, he described it as an inherited megalomaniac project which will never return on its investment. And you've never seen such a grumpy ribbon cutting ceremony in your life, and yet now he's saying no, it's going to be free for Zagreb residents. This is part of our plan for public transport, limiting private cars, because he's a member of Možemo, which is a green left movement in Croatia, and they're now saying, right, this is now part of our sustainable transport strategy. If you can prove that you are a Zagreb resident, then on the cable car you go for free. And potentially in the winter, this could be just about the cheapest skiing in Europe, I would have thought, if they actually get snow.
And just finally, though, if Juliet or Marcus or Goran shows up, and of course, I don't think any of them are residents of Zagreb, are you going to get fleeced then? Is this how they're subsidizing it?
No. It's not too bad at all. It was €4 when it started up. So okay. It wasn't the most expensive, but it's a great ride. It's a 20-minute ride. It actually goes up and down at various points as well. So it's quite an unusual cable car ride.
Guy Delaney, we'll hear more from you, of course, from Serbia during Xi Jinping's tour this week. That's our Guy Delaney joining us from Ljubljana this morning. It's at 10:51, almost 10:52 here in Zurich at Monocle's HQ. We want to, of course, from time to time, introduce our listeners to new media outlets. And today we want to introduce Le Grand Continent, which is a magazine that features interviews from prominent political intellectual figures, as well as in-depth articles on geopolitics and culture. And it's published, of course, in the main languages of European debate: French, Spanish, Italian, German, and Polish. And I'm very happy to say that Matteo Malik is joining us on the line this Sunday morning. Good morning, Matteo.
Good morning, Tyler. Good morning, all.
Just tell us, for those who are not familiar with your outlet, of course, you are, represented or backed also by a think tank as well, the Geopolitical mm-hmm. Studies Group, the GEG. If someone stumbles across you, what is your main mission as a media outlet?
So when we launched Grand Continent in 2019, together with Gilles Gressani, who is the director of the journal, and Ramona Bloch, we took a bet that is, I'd say, a multi-layered bet. First layer was that it is possible to launch an intellectual journal that is at times demanding for the reader in the 21st century, which was something that for us was obvious, but really non-existent in the landscape, at least in France, in Italy, and in Spain. Second layer was it is possible to do it at the European level and in the languages, as you said, of the European debate. Today, we publish in French, in Spanish, and Italian, sometimes in Polish and in German, but we don't have the full versions of those two languages. It's planned for the next months to come. And finally, the third layer was the idea that we could reach a wide and a large audience with our content. So the general idea was to create a platform for, to sum it up, strategical, political, and intellectual debates in Europe.
And in that context, when you talk about debate, of course, we can have debate on page and we can have a moderated or hosted debate on screen. But I'm wondering, how does this come to life? And I guess, you know, how does it ripple beyond your pages, beyond your screen in terms of, because, of course, we were talking at the top of this program, Goran was talking about that notion of debate, the need for maybe more candid discussions, as much as Juliet, you're saying, you know, what your daughter would like to see from her school, Marcus, as well, what's happening on your campus. What type of debate are you looking to encourage?
That's an interesting question because it's also at the core of what we do. We try to, so we have weekly debates, in-person weekly debates on Mondays in Italy for the Italian version of Grand Continent, on Tuesday in Paris in French, and on Wednesday in Spanish. And that for us is really key. It's really important. The idea of these debates is that they last for 1 hour with three or four people. And the point of entry of any of these debates is an article published in the journal. And so the idea is that the life cycle of an article is not just online or on print, because we also have a print edition, a yearly print edition. But also, you know, in real life, the idea is when we ask someone to write an article, to write a piece, we publish long reads, you know, sometimes it's more than 10 pages. The idea is that this article can have also a life of itself in the real world and in places of debate, where, of course, the debate is less, you know, exigent and demanding as the reading of the article. But the idea is also to have sort of this virtuous cycle where debate generates maybe more articles and more debates, etc. So that's really an important principle for us. That's you don't publish a journal to you know, stay there and not move. And it's all, there's always this dynamic that we want to put forward.
And I guess one of the problems with debate now is also people would like debates to happen within a safe space. So therefore, mm-hmm. this notion that you have a debate, but then you're not going to say anything, which is too controversial, which is rather contradictory and counterproductive. Is when you talk about debate, is it sort of truly with, yeah, I mean, hopefully with a degree of cordiality, but also that sometimes spiky things are going to be said.
Yeah, for us, we had this idea since the beginning, really. The problem, I think, with some outlets is that at some point you end up publishing things, you know, to satisfy your audience, because you know that your audience is more, you know, left-wing or right-wing, or they think that. And so the things you publish, but sometimes it is also unconscious, but you publish things that will satisfy your audience. For us, you know, we focus on the things that matter. And so since the beginning of, you know, the existence of Grand Continent, we have published a perspective from, leading political figures, sometimes people from the far left, and sometimes also speeches, for instance, or texts, of course, contextualized and commented, but also from the far right, because we think that it's important to that the reader, they have this point of view. For instance, you cannot understand today's political strategy of the far right in Europe if you don't read the verbatims of the speeches of Viktor Orban that really are, you know, something. Of course, you need to have an introductions and comments, and that's what we have. And that's a very old tradition, I might say, to return to the source, contextualize it, and bring context. And at the end of the day, you need to have this sort of landscape of ideas, because ideas come from everywhere. You cannot stay in one stream. That's a very important principle for us. You know, to be able to not to be with someone or behind someone in the exchequer of politics, but since the table is always moving, you need to take a step back and see how the pieces move on the chessboard.
Matteo Malik, editor-in-chief of Le Grand Continent, thank you very much for joining us. That's all the time we have for today's program. Juliet Lindley, great seeing you here. Marcus Schugel as well. Goran Filic, of course, a new voice around the table. Also, Emma Nelson back in London and our very own Nick Manise, Guy Delaney in Ljubljana. And I want to say a huge thanks to David Stevens, also Mariella Bevan, our producers and sound engineers today. I'm Tyler Brulé. Monocle on Sunday is back next week from Zurich. Have a good week. Goodbye.